From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
At a time when the Bush administration is undermining virtually every arms control regime out there, the Nobel Prize is sending an important message of the importance of creating rules of the road to keep nuclear weapons out of terrorist hands.
He has failed sufficiently to address the fact that the official nuclear powers are not in conformity with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and are failing sufficiently to reduce their arsenals. I feel that the Nobel Prize is an award for failure.
Today, a debate on the Nobel Peace Prize going to Mohammed al-Baradei and the International Atomic Energy Agency. We'll speak with British columnist George Monbiot and former senior Clinton official Nancy Soderbergh. Then the death toll in Central America from Hurricane Stan has climbed to more than 1,000. We'll go to Guatemala for a report. And we'll speak with a woman on the run, Diane Wilson. She's wanted in the state of Texas for protesting Dow Chemical.
I'm considered a dangerous woman in Calhoun County, and I am on the lam, and I'll stay on the lam until Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, goes to jail with me.
Warren Anderson is wanted in India for the Bhopal disaster. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from Saturday's massive earthquake in South Asia has topped 42,000. 10,000 people are believed to have died in the capital of the Pakistani-controlled Kashmir. United Nations estimates 2.5 million people have been left homeless. About 1,000 hospitals have been completely destroyed. The rescue effort has been hampered by the inability of the government to reach remote regions of the area and worsening weather. Earlier today, Pakistani authorities had to suspend all helicopter flights to quake-hit areas because of torrential rainstorms. Hundreds of thousands of Kashmiris are braving the cold weather with no shelter and little food. On Monday, rescue workers tried desperately to remove survivors trapped in collapsed buildings. This is Graham Payne, director of the group Rapid UK.
We've got three people out alive, which is very encouraging, and we're quite encouraged there still might be more people alive in there.
Earlier today, Doctors Without Borders warned there was a growing risk of an epidemic of waterborne disease in Pakistani Kashmir. The Pakistani government has made an urgent appeal for field hospitals, as well as antibiotics, anti-typhoid medicines, fracture treatment kits, and surgical equipment, among other supplies. This is Ed Swee, director of the United Nations Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
Already initially, it has been identified and confirmed by the government of Pakistan that the area which require most assistance include shelter, food items, medicines, logistic support, particularly helicopters, as well as field hospitals.
That was Ed Swee of the United Nations. Meanwhile, rescue efforts continue halfway around the globe in Guatemala, where mudslides have buried towns in up to 20 feet of mud. More than 650 people are confirmed dead, 1,400 still listed missing and believed to have been buried alive. The government is considering declaring certain areas to be mass graves. One firefighter said, quote, "If it had been an earthquake, you would hope to find survivors. But here in the mud, I don't think so. It could take up to a month for it to dry up," he said. Villagers in one of the worst-hit towns, Panabaj, refused to allow in the army because of memories of a 1990 army massacre. We'll go to Guatemala for a report in a few minutes. In Iraq, two car bombings today have killed dozens of Iraqis. Reuters reports at least 25 people were killed by a suicide car bombing in Baghdad. In the northwest town of Talafar, near the Syrian border, a car bomb exploded in a crowded market, killing at least 30 people. This comes after at least 13 Iraqis and one U.S. soldier were killed in Baghdad on Monday. Also in Iraq, arrest warrants have been issued for several officials from the U.S.-backed interim government of former Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. According to the Associated Press, five ministers, including Alawi's defense minister, Hazem Shalan, are among 28 ex-officials accused of misappropriating $1 billion in military funds. Most of the officials have already fled the country. Meanwhile, a new CBS News poll shows 59% of Americans want U.S. troops to leave Iraq as soon as possible, even if the country is not completely stable, an increase from 52% last month. Iraqis are 4 days away from voting in a nationwide referendum on a new constitution drafted by the transitional government. The Bush administration has reportedly considered launching military strikes on Iraq's neighbor, Syria, and finding someone to replace Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. Newsweek reports at a high-level meeting held on October 1st, U.S. officials debated striking training camps inside the Syrian border used by insurgents, they say, in Iraq. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice declined yesterday to verify the magazine's account that she'd successfully opposed the strikes. Meanwhile, the Financial Times is reporting Bush's security adviser, Stephen Hadley, is coordinating an interagency search for someone to replace al-Assad as president of Syria. The U.S. has accused Syria of harboring Iraqi insurgents and aiding Palestinian and Lebanese militias. One administration official told Newsweek last month that military planning around the country and Iran is busier than ever. Last week, Fox News television host Bill O'Reilly called for al-Assad's assassination, saying, quote, "We should take his life if he doesn't help us out." In Germany, a political stalemate has ended with a power-sharing deal that'll elevate the conservative Angela Merkel to become the country's new chancellor. As part of the deal, the Social Democrats, former Chancellor Gerhard Schröder's party, will get a majority of cabinet positions. Merkel is Germany's first female chancellor and the first chancellor born in East Germany. This news from the United Nations. The U.S. Ambassador, John Bolton, has blocked a U.N. envoy from addressing the Security Council on human rights violations in the Darfur region of Sudan. Bolton said that, quote, "We should talk about next steps, not about how to arrange the furniture in the Security Council." The envoy, Juan Mendez, told reporters the human rights situation is, quote, "much more dangerous and worrisome than he'd expected, with, quote, massive attacks of an indiscriminate nature against civilians in camps in Darfur." Mendez added that the Sudanese government is refusing to cooperate with an international criminal court investigation into war crimes in Sudan. Bolton is one of the Bush administration's fiercest opponents of the Hague-based court. Meanwhile, two African Union troops and two civilian contractors were killed in the region Saturday, the first members of the AU mission to lose their lives. In China, one of the country's leading democracy activists is recovering from a brutal assault. Liu Bangli was on his way to Taishi, a key village in the growing regional unrest that The Guardian newspaper calls, quote, "the greatest threat to the rule of the Communist Party since the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989. Liu was stopped by a group of five police, five soldiers, and as many as 50 people in plain clothes. The mob dragged Liu out of the car and kicked him unconscious. Liu was taken to his hometown of Zhejiang, where he is recovering from his injuries. In New Orleans, three city police officers have pleaded not guilty to charges of battery after they were videotaped beating an African-American man in the French Quarter on Saturday. Police hit the 64-year-old retired elementary school teacher at least four times in the head, then dragged him to the ground. An officer also kneed him in the back as blood streamed down his arm. Police also assaulted a producer from the Associated Press after he refused to stop filming the attack. On Monday, the victim of the beating, Robert Davis, spoke out for the first time. Davis denied police reports that he was drunk. Davis said he had returned to New Orleans to check on property his family owns in the storm-ravaged city and was out looking to buy cigarettes when he was beaten and arrested. Davis has several stitches in his face and a possible skull fracture. Security on New York City subways is being scaled back after an intelligence threat of a major attack on the city's underground transportation system has been discredited. Law enforcement officials told the New York Times that an investigation has yielded no evidence that a plot was in motion or being actively contemplated. From the outset, federal officials have cast doubt on the intelligence that allegedly revealed the threat. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Police Commissioner Ray Kelly have vigorously defended their decision to go public. Bloomberg has so far refused to release any specific details on the threat. He announced it just hours before he was scheduled to take part in a mayoral debate on Thursday with challengers running against him in the upcoming city elections. And the results are in from a recent BBC poll to find the individual most people would like to lead a fantasy world government. Nelson Mandela came in first, followed by Bill Clinton, the Dalai Lama, Noam Chomsky, and Alan Greenspan. President Bush came in 43rd, below both Cuban President Fidel Castro and Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi was the highest-ranking woman at number 13. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Friday, the International Atomic Energy Agency and its chief, Mohammed al-Baradei, were awarded the 2005 Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. The Egyptian-born al-Baradei has served as director general of the IAEA since 1997. Speaking to reporters in Vienna soon after the announcement, he called the prize a, quote, shot in the arm for the agency. Al-Baradei won the prize just months after the United States tried to force him from his job after the Bush administration repeatedly clashed with him over Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. In the run-up to the Iraq War, al-Baradei argued that nuclear experts had found no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He called the launch of the U.S.-led invasion, quote, the saddest day of my life. Leaders from across the globe have come in support of the Nobel Peace Committee's selection of al-Baradei and the IAEA. This is UN Secretary General Kofi Annan.
I think it's a message for all of us that we should take the issue of non-proliferation and disarmament very, very seriously.
But not everyone has come in support of al-Baradei and the International Atomic Energy Agency. A number of environmental groups and activists are criticizing the Nobel Peace Prize Committee for their selection. The French group, Sortir du Nucléaire, or Get Out of Nuclear, criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency for what they called promoting civilian nuclear plants. Meanwhile, Greenpeace was also critical of the selection.
We're really shocked because the Atomic Agency has been responsible for over 50 years to promote the spread of nuclear technology. And this is the cause of the spread of nuclear weapons. Every country with a nuclear reactor has enough plutonium every year to produce about 30 nuclear weapons. So there is a direct link between nuclear power and nuclear bombs.
Jan van de Poot of Greenpeace. To talk more about the selection of Mohammed al-Baradei and the IAEA for the Nobel Peace Prize, we're joined by two guests. George Monbiot, author and columnist for the London Guardian, joins us in line from Britain. And on the line from Florida, Nancy Soderberg. She held senior positions in the National Security Council staff of President Clinton and the U.S. delegation to the U.N. She's author of the book The Superpower Myth, The Use and Misuse of American Might. Well, let's begin with Nancy Soderberg. Why do you think the IAEA and its chief are a good choice for this year's Nobel Peace Prize? And welcome.
Well, I think it's a brilliant choice because at a time when the Bush administration has been undermining virtually the entire alphabet soup of arms, sends a strong message of the importance of that. And the head, Dr. Mohammed al-Baradei, deserves great credit for transforming what was a very sleepy, useless organization during the Cold War into a real force for change.
George Monbiot, your thoughts.
Well, I think the man from Greenpeace was largely right. While it is true that al-Baradei has stood up to the United States and to the United Kingdom, who have both done their best to wreck the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, he has not stood up to the fundamental contradiction within that treaty and the fundamental contradiction within his role, which is that he is simultaneously charged with stopping the spread of military nuclear technology and facilitating the spread of civil military technology. When you stop to consider that all the new nuclear states or attempted nuclear states have achieved their nuclear status by transforming their civil nuclear programs into military nuclear programs, you realize that with the one hand, he has been quite effectively trying to prevent proliferation, and on the other hand, he's been even more effectively helping proliferation. And the fact that he has never publicly stood up and said, there is a real problem with this role, there's a fundamental contradiction in the mandate of the IAEA and a fundamental contradiction in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, means that he has unfortunately done more harm than good during his tenure.
Nancy Soderberg, your response.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have the utmost respect for Greenpeace and those who around the world who are advocating nuclear disarmament, which is a goal that's probably, you know, decades away from even being seriously talked about. I think the Clinton administration had that goal. The previous presidents have had that goal. I think this particular administration is trying to create new nuclear weapons, not trying to move forward towards disarmament. But Al-Baradei has to deal with the real world. And the real world today is that there is an increasing number of civilian nuclear plants around the world, and he's trying to work to make sure that any nuclear technologies are contained, controlled, and inspected. He's been trying to get Brazil, for instance, to allow inspectors in there. He's working on the cutting edge of trying to push Iran back from the brink of a nuclear weapons. So he's trying to swim against the tide of nuclear proliferation. I don't think it's a dual role at all. I think his job is to try and recognize reality that there are civilian plants. Let's keep them civilian uses of nuclear energy and make sure that there's total control over nuclear weapons. He's put forward a couple of years ago a very interesting proposal to create centers of international inspection for any civilian plant so that the dangerous materials that are the waste from some of these civilian nuclear plants will be maintained and kept away from rogue states, new nuclear weapon states, and perhaps most importantly, terrorists. And I think you also have to look at the context in which this award was given. This is a man who, against great international pressure, stood up to the United States and said, actually, there are no nuclear weapons in Iraq, opposed the invasion. He's been on the cutting edge of trying to get a more responsible stance from Washington and trying to create a carrot and stick approach in Iran. In fact, Bush administration has essentially adopted that program. Too little, too late, so there's now a much tougher regime in Iran. But I think this is a man who's greatly advanced the cause of proliferation against great odds and deserves great credit for it.
Nancy, with George respect, Mambia, I feel you haven't addressed my point. The point I'm making is that part of the reason why there's been a great increase in civil nuclear facilities which could be turned into military nuclear facilities is that the organization which Mr. Al-Baradei runs is actually charged with increasing the proliferation of civil nuclear facilities. One of his official roles is to spread so-called atoms for peace and encourage countries to adopt civil nuclear technology and indeed encourage the official nuclear powers to give that civil nuclear technology to the non-nuclear powers. And partly as a result of the efforts of the IAEA and the Non-Proliferation Treaty, every state, Israel, South Africa, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Iraq, which has sought to develop a nuclear weapons program over the past 30 years, has done so by diverting resources from its nuclear power program, and that nuclear power program, in most of those cases, has been promoted and developed by the IAEA. If you look, for example, at what's happened in India, as a result of the brokerage by the IAEA, Canada, the United States, Germany, France, Norway, and the United Kingdom provided India with all the materials it needed to develop its nuclear bombs. Similarly, in Pakistan, Canada, the US, Germany, France, Belgium, China, and the United Kingdom again provided all the materials they required to develop their nuclear bombs. And it's Al-Baradei who's been going around the world saying, hey, we can put you together with these countries which have got nuclear materials. They can help you develop a civil nuclear facility. And then a few years later, he turns around and says, oh, my gosh, you've used this civil nuclear facility to produce nuclear weapons. Well, that's very unfortunate, and you really shouldn't be doing it. He's actually been spreading proliferation.
Well, I think, I mean,
Nancy Soderbergh,
greatly exaggerating the role of the IAEA in these efforts by most of the countries that you mentioned to seek access to technology for nuclear power energies. And we can have a debate about whether nuclear energy should be eliminated from the face of the earth. I don't think that that's a realistic proposal. We have nuclear energy plants, and we're going to have nuclear energy plants, plants for the foreseeable future.
Those plants are the spread around the world.
The question here is, on the large picture of trying to rein in the threat of nuclear proliferation, the IAEA has done an extraordinary job of trying to contain those civilian plants from diverting nuclear weapons into nuclear weapons products into weapons. And you know, just take, for instance, the role that they're playing right now with Iran. They have been pressing for some kind of approach in Iran that had some chance of realism towards it and for you know, the last 4.5 years, the Bush administration has been saying, we don't do carrots, we're not going to push this. They followed the same proposal towards the North Korean program. Meanwhile, both countries are beginning, you know, North Korea is just sitting there turning out two types of nuclear weapons. Iran is marching merrily towards a weapons production capability, and we have yet to put forward a proposal until recently where the Europeans and the Bush administration came together and put forward a proposal. It's now been referred to the Security Council, and the IAEA will be smack in the middle of these negotiations. It's very late. You have a harder line regime now in Iran, so I think it's going to be very difficult there. But this comes at a time that IAEA is looking at the current threats today, and the efforts of the Nobel Peace Prize to recognize that those were not a fight about the civilian uses of nuclear energy, but on the cutting edge of the threats that we face today, which are Iran, North Korea, what was going on in Iraq, and trying to maintain control, international control, over the many nuclear power plants around the world, which are a fact of life.
Nancy Soderbergh, I wanted to ask you a question. Holding senior positions on the National Security Council staff of President Clinton, you talked about how al-Baradei had from the beginning said that Iraq didn't have nuclear weapons. Mohammed al-Baradei calling the launch of the U.S.-led invasion the saddest day of his life. And yet the whole democratic establishment in this country, I mean the establishment, the core of it, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton here in New York, John Kerry, John Edwards, the presidential candidate and vice presidential candidate of the Democratic Party, all voted to authorize the invasion. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, at the time, I think there was a general consensus that Iraq had chemical and biological weapons because he had never accounted for those that we knew he had at the end of the 1991 Gulf War. There was a large.
But as you're saying, al-Baradei himself was saying it was the saddest day of his life. He was saying no, the man that, you know, you're applauding now. So why didn't the Democratic establishment support that at the time?
There was a general consensus on the chemical and biological weapons, which turned out to be wrong. But I think the Bush administration blatantly was putting forward false information that he had nuclear weapons. And, you know, that whole famous Joe Wilson trip, that whether or not they acquired those efforts from Nigeria. But there was a misinformation campaign on the nuclear side from the Bush administration that those who followed it very closely, generally like myself, or I was, you know, in the administration up until 2001, generally felt that they did not have nuclear weapons. And al-Baradei was one of the few international folks to actually stand up and say, no, in fact, they do not have nuclear weapons. So
well,
there's a gray area on the chemical and biological weapons, but al-Baradei turned out to be, you know, quite right. I have the quote right here. He said, no evidence or plausible indication of a revival of the nuclear weapons program in Iraq.
And yet it was the nuclear weapons that were the most frightening and the most often cited in the U.S. Congress when the Congress members and senators stood up and supported the invasion. It was the threat of the nuclear mushroom. Yet you had these people like al-Baradei. Why weren't they taken seriously at the time?
Well, I think that the Democrats here are having a hard time justifying their stance on the position other than to say that they were under the impression that the threat was imminent from the President of the United States, and they believe that the President has the right to make that decision. I think there's a lot of Democrats sort of scratching their head on that point right now, but I think at the time, Democrats were not standing up to President Bush. And I think you also have to remember this is right after 9/11. The whole country was in a bit of a fetal position after that and is only now emerging to sort of challenge what's going on. That's why the morass of Katrina and those others are sort of a wake-up call to the rest of the country that, hey, wait a minute, these guys may not be as competent as they have claimed to be over the last 4.5 years. And I think you're seeing the removal of the rose-colored glasses that have been on most of the eyes of many of our country's leaders and the press and as well. And they're beginning now to finally questioning the competency of this administration.
George Monbiot.
Well, I do think the Democrats have been completely pathetic. And in the run-up to the war with Iraq, it was very striking that large numbers of people on both sides of the Atlantic could see that Bush was lying. They could see that there was no threat from Saddam Hussein, nuclear, chemical, or biological. They could see that even if he possessed chemical or biological weapons, he had no intention and no means of attacking the West with those weapons. And the sense of intense frustration
with both the Democratic Party in the United States and the Labour Party in the United Kingdom was palpable among liberal people on both sides of the Atlantic, and it was a perpetual mystery to us why our supposed representatives, the people whom we had elected to represent our views, could not see the very obvious things that the rest of us could see. And it seemed to us that they had been mesmerized and bamboozled by Bush and by Blair, and that they had quite willingly and deliberately accepted their lies. And I still feel an enormous amount of resentment towards the Labour Party as a whole over here and the Democrat Party as a whole in the United States.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. George Monbiot is author of Manifesto for a New World Order. Nancy Soderberg, high-level Clinton administration official in the National Security Council and also on the UN staff. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we turn to a longtime environmental activist from Texas who's on the lam. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We are broadcasting on over 375 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations, NPR radio stations, and low-power FM stations, on public access TV, PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're podcasting at democracynow.org. Our transcripts are there, as well as the video and audio streams of this broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to longtime Texas environmental activist Diane Wilson. She's joining us here in our Firehouse studios. I want to begin by reading from the new issue of the Corporate Crime Reporter. It says Diane Wilson is facing 4 months of jail in Texas, but she now says she's not going to jail until Warren Anderson, the former CEO of Union Carbide, is extradited to face manslaughter charges in Bhopal, India. Anderson was CEO of Union Carbide on December 3, 1984, when a deadly gas attack from Union Carbide's pesticide factory in Bhopal, India, poisoned at least 500,000 people. More than 8,000 died within 3 days. Over 20,000 have died to date as a result of their exposure. In August 2002, Wilson scaled a Dow Chemical Facility in Seadrift, Texas, and unfurled a banner that read, "Dow Responsible for Bhopal." When she came down, she was arrested and charged with criminal trespass. In January 2003, Wilson was convicted of that charge and sentenced to 4 months in prison, fined $2,000. Now, Diane Wilson says she'll refuse to go to jail until Warren Anderson goes to jail. She joins us in our studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Why are you so focused on Warren Anderson?
Well, I'm a fisherwoman, and I come from a very small town where there's a lot of corporations. And I have been to India, and I've talked with the survivors from the Bhopal emissions. And matter of fact, I've even had them come to Seadrift, and we went to the Union Carbide plant so they could talk to the plant managers there. And I believe the only way that these people will have justice is if Warren Anderson goes back to India and stand trial. That was, in the beginning, that was a part of the compromise that they had made with the Indian government, that they would give them this pittance of money and that they would show up for trial. That was the one thing that the Union Carbide executives, the corporation, Warren Anderson, they turned and just walked away from it. And Warren Anderson jumped bail, I believe, 13 years ago.
Now, Warren Anderson was CEO of Union Carbide, which has since been bought by Dow.
That's right.
So what's Dow's responsibility now?
Dow's responsibility, they claim all the profits, and we believe they claim the liabilities also. I do know that they have taken on Union Carbide's liabilities in the United States. There was a case where a child was contaminated with some of Union Carbide's pesticide, and I believe the American child received up to $6 million. And the children over in India, a lot of them received nothing at all. And some of them just, you know, like $500.
You found Warren Anderson here in this country. Can you talk about what happened?
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, they had been trying to extradite him to India for a long time, and the FBI kept saying, well, they couldn't find Warren Anderson. They just had no idea where that man was. Well, actually, it was Greenpeace who found him first, and once we heard that Warren Anderson was in Southampton on Long Island, I was in New York one day, so I just decided just to go by his house and stand out front, and I had a big sign. It said, Warren, shouldn't you be in India? And I actually had no idea that he was inside. You'd see, every once in a while, you'd see a curtain pull back. And I was really surprised when he and his wife walked out. There was a radio reporter was out and interviewing me, and Warren Anderson abruptly, he strode out there with his wife. And matter of fact, he and the reporter started fighting over the microphone, and I thought we was going to have a fight in the street at that point. And all he did was he said that we had no idea what we was doing. He had been to India. He wasn't going back again. And he wanted to know where I was from because, you know, he assumed I was a professional environmentalist. And I said, well, I was a fisherman from Sea Drift, Texas, and there's a Union Carbide plant there. And he said, there's no Union Carbide plant in Sea Drift. And I said, well, I can get a picture of it and show it to you. And he refused to. You know, he just believed what we were, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. We were misinformed.
Speaking of reporters, didn't a television producer pull up at that point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, matter of fact, I believe it was 60 Minutes.
The executive producer, Don Hewitt.
And he was extremely pissed off at us for being there. He said we didn't know any of the facts. They had been over there, they checked the facts, and that Warren Anderson was, as far as he was concerned, Warren Anderson was innocent, and he said, personally, I wouldn't go back over there either.
So, right now, why exactly are you considered on the lam? You could be arrested if you were in Texas right now, but not here in New York?
I could be, the minute I step foot in Texas, I could be arrested, and when I talked with my attorney, he said he just didn't believe they were going to send the Texas Rangers up here. You know, he didn't know if there was extradition clean to, well, I hate to say where I'm at, so they won't send someone here. But, yes, I'm arrestable at any point that I step back into Texas.
We're talking to Diane Wilson, a fourth-generation shrimper turned environmental activist from Sea Drift, Texas. Diane has also written a book. It's just out. It's the story of her life. It's called An Unreasonable Woman, a true story of shrimpers, politicos, polluters, and the fight for Sea Drift, Texas. Last week, Diane, explosions shook the Formosa Plastics Corporation plant in Port Lavaca, Texas, injuring at least 13 workers. The explosion occurred just a year and a half after five workers for the company were killed in a blast at its plant in Illinois. Formosa's plant employs around 1,500 people. Last April, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality fined the facility $150,000 for violations of air pollution laws that included releases of toxic chemicals like vinyl chloride. Over the past decade, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has inspected the plant dozens times, five of them resulting in violations. Can you talk about this plant? You take on a lot of chemical plants from Union Carbide to Formosa.
I've been doing this activism probably 16 years now, and I've probably spent the majority of the time on Formosa Plastics. I probably know more about this chemical plant than Formosa knows about it. Matter of fact, I've had Formosa executives call me and ask me where I was getting my information, because I had information that even they didn't know, and I've got to know.
Where are you getting it?
Well, I was talking to the workers, and apparently the company isn't talking to the workers. And matter of fact, a lot of times that there would be a release and the company would report this minute little release, and I was talking to the worker, and when they found out I was talking to the worker, they would call me and was like, well, how much is a worker saying is being released? Because they didn't know what kind of trouble they were going to get into by, you know, what small amount that they were saying was being released.
So talk about what is happening at Formosa, the third explosion to strike the industrial facility in Texas this year.
Well, I was there when the plant was being constructed. It was the biggest expansion in Texas history, and Texas is known for big expansions. And when they started, they had like 400 contractors, and they were working on top of each other. And one of the things about Formosa, the way they have been able to be so profitable, is they're constantly pushing to get things up and running. So they were, at some instances, they were building the side of the process units before they even had the cement down. And I know one of the workers, he fell from like 75 foot, and he didn't die because he hit the ground and because there was no foundation underneath of it. And I've had workers that said that they were supposed to be laying the pipes in the cement, and the cement was laid before the pipes were laid. And so they were having chainsaws and these cement saws trying to saw into cement. And I think on the one instance he said, well, they couldn't get that pipe in that cement, so they were going to have to just have this vacuum truck handy to take up all the process water all the time. And this plant, they were constantly using cheap material. There was no training. Like a lot of the workers that were doing the wells, you know, they have to be x-rayed. They were failing the wells. I know one of the buildings totally collapsed, and Formosa was saying, oh, it was a tornado that hit, and it was, you know, this little 20-mile-an-hour wind came through and knocked the thing over because there weren't even bolts in the thing.
What about the casualties? In March, BP's Texas City oil refinery burst into flames, killing 15, injuring 170 people. In July, the refinery exploded again. And this week in Congress, the Republican leadership pushed through a bill that would make it easier for oil refineries to build new domestic facilities. The legislation will streamline government permits for refineries, open federal lands for future refinery construction, weaken environmental protections, and offer subsidies to build refineries, even though oil companies are making record profits now.
Well I tell you what I think about it, because I know the workers that worked in that BP refinery plant in Texas City, and I know
that's British Petroleum.
Yeah, that's British Petroleum, and I know because they would come when I would talk to them, and they'd say, "Whoop, just had a near miss today. The plant just nearly went." And the thing of it is there has been so much wrong about how these facilities are being built. And then also, they're getting rid of the, you know, there's a real big effort to get rid of the unions, which is, you know, which, and they're real strict about the training, about the quality, and most of these corporations, that's one of their big efforts, is to get rid of the unions. And, you know, I just think it's just another disaster waiting to happen.
Talk about your activism and what got you started. You're the mother of five kids?
Five kids, right. My mother says I should have known better, but I started because I was running a shrimp boat, and shrimping was so bad, I was running a fish house. And in 1989, one of my shrimpers, he had three different types of cancers, and he had these lumps all over his arms. And he gave me an Associated Press story that said that my county, which is, I mean, it's real tiny little county. It's like 15,000 in the entire thing. And we were number one in the nation for toxic disposal. And that just blew my mind. And the thing with it is, I had never heard about it. I had never read it in the paper. I had never saw it on TV. And to find out you're number one in the entire country, I couldn't get wrapped that around my head.
Where in Texas is it?
It's Calhoun County. It's right on the Texas Gulf Coast. We're about midway between Corpus Christi and Galveston. And so all I did was call a meeting over that little report, and I got such a backlash. I mean, people, especially officials, bank presidents, chamber of commerce, economic development, senators, they got furious that I would even question the chemical plants.
The DA asked how he could get you to stop doing what you're doing?
That's right. It was during my punishment phase, and he was real serious. And he said, "What is it going to take to make you stop?" And I said, "There isn't a single thing you can do to make me stop." And quite frankly, I'm not afraid of jail. I truly am not. I think it's I think my activism is like my path, and I think everything you do, you have to do it with integrity. And my taking the punishment is a part of it. But I go ahead. I'm
How
sorry.
Do you link Diane Wilson, your protest around these environmental issues and the oil refineries in Texas where you live, with the war in Iraq? Talk about the protest September 2002 in Washington, D.C., Armed Services Committee questioning Donald Rumsfeld. What'd you do?
Well, it was actually a very spontaneous idea. I was with Medea Benchman, and she was in Washington, D.C.
Code Pink.
Yeah, with Code Pink. And she said, "Why don't I come up to Washington, D.C.?" And we were trying to think of something we could do, and we had heard that Donald Rumsfeld was going to be before the Service Arms Committee. So we made a banner that night about 11 o'clock. It was still wet. I remember I went to a little thrift shop and got me a pink suit. I've never had a suit on in my life, and I put on a pink suit. And we stood in the section to where they were allowing people to get inside. And when it came time to allow the citizens in, the Capitol cop, he pointed to me and Medea, and he just said, "Come here, little ladies." And he put us right behind Donald Rumsfeld. And it was like fate. I'd never felt so much like fate had put us right there. It was perfect. And there was a million cameras and all the military with their shiny brass and all of those senators. And when he started talking about Iraq and all the weapons of mass destruction, we just got right up and started shouting, "More inspections, no war."
Donald Rumsfeld comment after you started shouting that, as you were forcibly removed. "As I listened to those comments," he said, "it struck me what a wonderful thing free speech is. And of course, the country that threw the inspectors out was not the United States. It was not the United Nations. It was Iraq threw the inspectors out. But of course, people like this are not able to go into Iraq and make demonstrations like that because they don't have free speech." Those are the words of Donald Rumsfeld
as you were being taken out. That's what he said. And, you know, and I don't think the issue about Iraq is about freedom. I think it's about oil.
Are you continuing your activism now? Are you continuing your protests?
My protests for the war has started when I realized we were invading Iraq, and it will continue as long as we pursue this type of policy with the government. It will continue, right?
We're talking to Diane Wilson, fourth-generation shrimper-turned-environmental activist. Wrote the book An Unreasonable Woman, a true story of shrimpers, politicos, polluters, and the fight for Seadrift, Texas. Do you think you've made any progress? Do you think you've changed anyone's minds in Texas or in the rest of the country?
Well, I know when I was right before I got arrested for climbing that chemical tower, I was a part of a hunger strike supporting the Bhopal activists. At that time, the Indian government was going to drop the charges against Union Carbide, against Warren Anderson, and pretty much kill the whole justice movement with the Bhopal survivors. And I started a hunger strike in front of that plant in my truck. We had 1,000 people joined it. 8 different countries got involved. And at the end, the Indian government changed their mind, and they, matter of fact, kept the charges and, in fact, sent out extradition papers to the Justice Department. So I absolutely believe that people make a difference. Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Amy.
Diane Wilson, and we'll continue to follow your journey wherever it takes you. An Unreasonable Woman, that's the title of her book. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Guatemala. The death toll in Central America is still climbing, believed to be over 1,000 people dead. Stay with us.
Thank you, Amy.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll in Central America from Hurricane Stan is still climbing after torrential rains caused a deadly series of floods and mudslides. More than 650 people are confirmed dead in Guatemala. 1,400 more are still listed as missing, believed to have been buried alive. At least 100 others have died in Mexico and neighboring Central American countries. In the central highlands of Guatemala, whole villages have been destroyed by mudslides, burying thousands thousands alive, displacing tens of thousands of people. The Guatemalan president, Oscar Berger's government, widely criticized for responding too slowly to the tragedy. Hardly any federal aid has arrived in Panabash or the surrounding area, which was the hardest hit. The death toll could be as much as 1,500 there alone. On Monday, rescuers gave up after 5 days of searching for bodies that have been buried alive. Officials will likely declare the area a mass grave. Rescue efforts difficult because thousands of miles of roads and dozens of bridges have been wiped out by the mudslides. Rescuers have had to use boats and helicopters to bring in food and medicine. Guatemala has asked for $21 million in emergency help through the UN, and U.S. helicopters have ferried aid to some stricken areas on Monday. From Guatemala, we're joined by Paul Menchu. He is the brother of Rigoberta Menchu, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Paul heads the Rigoberta Menchu Foundation. We are also joined on the phone from Berkeley, California, by Beatrice Mons, anthropologist and professor at UC Berkeley. Her newest book is called Paradise and Ashes, A Guatemalan Journey of Courage, Terror, and Hope. She's Guatemalan. First, let us turn to Paul Menchu. On the ground, what do you know has happened? And he will be translated.
Buenos días, señor Menchu. Estamos en el aire. Gracias por estar aquí. ¿Nos podría explicar un poco cuál es la situación ahí en los pueblos?
Bien, buenos días.
Hello, good morning.
A partir del paso del huracán Stan que afectó Centroamérica y el sur de México.
Starting with the passing of Hurricane Stan, which affected Central America and Mexico.
Y donde los daños más fuertes han sido en Guatemala.
The worst damages have been in Guatemala.
La situación de gran parte de la población es de desabastecimiento, muerte y desesperanza.
Among the population, there are problems of lack of supplies, great death, and a loss of hope.
Porque esta tormenta cayó especialmente en una área muy poblada.
Because this storm hit the ground in a very populated region.
En toda la región de la costa sur de Guatemala y la sierra o altiplano donde vive la mayor parte de la población indígena del país.
This happened on the south coast and in the mountains of Guatemala where most of the indigenous population lives.
El principal problema han sido en la parte de la costa sur las inundaciones de agua.
The main problem has been on the south coast, where we have flooding.
Y en la parte del altiplano, los derrumbes y avalanchas de lodo que han sepultado poblaciones enteras.
And also mudslides and avalanches in the mountains, which have buried entire villages.
El otro problema que estamos enfrentando es que se han perdido gran parte de cultivos.
Another problem that we're facing is that we have lost a lot of our farms.
Por lo que también se teme que en corto plazo haya problemas de hambruna en Guatemala.
And this is going to mean in the short term that we're going to have hunger problems in Guatemala.
También está la situación de la salud.
There's also the situation of health.
Porque en algunos lugares donde no han podido ser retirados los muertos.
Because in some places where the dead have not been able to be removed.
Se temen epidemias y problemas de salud que ya se están viviendo por la falta de agua potable.
We're afraid of epidemics and health problems that will happen because of the lack of water.
Bueno, en general es una situación difícil para muchas comunidades que requerirá un gran esfuerzo de reconstrucción y también de buscar alternativas a corto plazo para tener una seguridad alimentaria.
So this is a big problem for many villages who will need to be entirely reconstructed and are also having lack of food problems.
Paul Menchu is on the line with us from Guatemala, the brother of Rigoberta Menchú, the Nobel Peace Prize winner from Guatemala. She spoke and has spoken out against the Guatemalan military for many years against the massacres in the highlands. On the phone with us also is a Guatemalan anthropologist, professor at the University of California, Berkeley, Beatrice Mans. We're getting reports that people, Professor Mans, are refusing to allow the military in at Panabash because of memories of the 1990 Santiago Atitlan massacre. Can you describe what happened then and why they'd feel this way today?
Well, it shouldn't be that surprising that the people in those villages and in villages throughout Guatemala would have this kind of reaction to the presence of the military. I mean, The people are facing a natural disaster right now, but for decades they faced a human-made tragedy, and the military's responsibility in hundreds of massacres, hundreds of thousands of deaths, and a genocide in that country creates obviously a mistrust. And a very, very poor image, to say the least. I mean, the soldiers have a very bad reputation. People remember the fear, the terror that they lived through. These are the survivors. And I'm not that surprised, tragically, that people do not want to see the soldiers come in and provide aid in this instance.
Are you, Paul Menchú, getting these reports of these terribly afflicted victims yet not wanting the army in because they're afraid?
Señor Menchú, hemos escuchado que en algunos lugares, por la historia de represión por parte de las Fuerzas Armadas, no están dejando entrar a estas Fuerzas Armadas para brindar ayuda a las comunidades. ¿Qué sabe usted de esto?
Sí, el caso particular de Santiago Atitlán, donde ha habido por lo menos dos comunidades, digamos, perdidas por una avalancha.
In the area of Santiago Atitlán, there have been two communities that were lost to avalanches.
En donde hay una fuerte población indígena muy organizada.
And in these areas, there's a very organized indigenous population.
Y donde, pues, si recordamos, efectivamente ahí ha sucedido una masacre en la década pasada.
And there is where the massacre happened in the last decade.
Entonces ahí se ha reportado, bueno, una resistencia a que puedan colaborar los militares porque, pues, está muy presente todavía en la memoria el terror que sufrieron por los militares.
And so these communities have resisted the soldiers coming in because there is a very strong memory of the terror that they brought to the communities in the past.
De hecho, la memoria y los acontecimientos que sucedieron en Guatemala, incluso en estas circunstancias, salen a luz nuevamente.
So the things that have happened in the past in Guatemala and this memory of the terror has come back to the surface now.
We have to wrap up, but I do want to ask if people want to support in the ways that they have hurricane victims of Hurricane Katrina, where can they go? Who do they turn to? Want to support the victims in Guatemala?
Hay algunas personas aquí que quieren brindar ayuda a los damnificados del huracán. ¿Qué pueden hacer desde Estados Unidos para ayudar en esta situación?
Bien, yo creo que uno es a través de organizaciones que ya están establecidas como la Cruz Roja, por ejemplo.
Mm-hmm. One way is through already organized organizations such as the Red Cross.
Otro es a través de las ONGs y organizaciones. De hecho, la Fundación Rigoberta Menchú Tum está trabajando en estas áreas.
Another way is through NGOs that are working in the area, and in fact, the Rigoberta Menchú Tomb Foundation is working in this area.
We're going to have to leave it there. We will certainly make the links. I want to thank Gretchen Begley for translating. Thank you, Paul Menchú, for being with us from the Rigoberta Menchú Tomb Foundation, and Beatrice Mons, author of Paradise and Ashes, A Guatemalan Journey of Courage, Terror, and Hope. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdoka Douche, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Susie Salami, Maddie Harper, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.